It's Let's Talk Legal on the Talk Station, FM 107.1. And joining us this afternoon, we have Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins. I'm getting all of this backwards. We've got it, Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins of Harvell and Collins. And of course, as always, I'd like to remind you, don't hesitate to give them a call. As a matter of fact, that's one thing I would strongly recommend as you're listening to the program. If you hear any questions or have any questions or have any thoughts, please give them a call, 252 area code 726-9050, or you can go online to harvellandcollins.com. Spell out the word and, please, A-N-D, harvellandcollins.com. But that number, again, 252 area code 726-9050. And with that, Cecil, Wes, good afternoon to you.
Afternoon, Lockwood.
Good afternoon, Lockwood. Last week, we discussed kind of what Wes and I have referred to as some pretty monstrous mistakes, big mistakes, and things that we see. And our listeners are welcome to clue into the website or Instagram or Facebook and listen to those comments last week. And this week we're going to kind of continue. Now, right out of the gate, Lockwood, our law firm does a lot of assisting clients with helping them find ways to pay for, if you will, long-term care and assisted living. There is a difference and distinction between assisted living and how one might qualify for some assistance with assisted living, and long-term care or nursing care and how one might qualify for some help with those circumstances financially. One of the things that always comes up in our files is the mistake of, you know, gifting to the children, thinking that we can just transfer our assets within, at the end of our life. Mm-hmm. Now, the first thing is that Wes and I have spoken before on the program that when you enter vivos or during your life gift property to anyone, children, grandchildren, you gift to them as well your tax basis in the property, which is usually quite low, and therefore you deny the beneficiary the opportunity to have a step-up in basis in the property. Now, I know that might sound a bit technical, and if it does, our listeners are welcome to call Wes or myself, and we'll explain it in more detail. But the bottom line for a radio program is that giving your home or property or farm or whatever it might be to your heirs during your lifetime has significant tax consequences. That's the bottom line. And it should not be done without without a lot of discussion and comprehensive understanding of what the tax consequences happen to be. Now, if you gift either land, home, place, farm, et cetera, or money, within 5 years of qualifying for any kind of government assistance in a long-term care facility, then those gifts are going to be brought back into the formula. They're going to be analyzed, and they very likely, in many of our files, create a sanction period, which can be significant. So as our loved ones get older and as we become potentially a candidate for either assisted living or long-term care, that really is the time to seek out an elder law attorney and sit down with the lawyer and kind of get information relative to exactly how you can go about the planning. It's a very important thing to do, and consistent with kind of the theme of the program last week and this week, if you don't do that and you take action without the counsel of a lawyer, you probably are making a big mistake.
Oh, yeah. There's, you know, many mistakes that we see in this area of long-term health care planning. A lot of undone things that are partially done. Some things we can fix, some things we can't. Mm-hmm. So as you know, sometimes we see situations where everything seems just hunky-dory and perfect because the assets have been moved around a little bit, or maybe the house has been structured in a way where we have a spouse living there, or maybe it's been there's been a deed done that maybe attempts to convey a remainder interest. But see, these type things, Lockwood and Cecil, can take place and everything can seem just fine, and long-term health care assistance through the state and federal government can be approved, and then the person who is in the care facility can be receiving, you know, significant long-term adult Medicaid benefits. And then when they pass away, we have to deal with how things are structured. And if they're not structured correctly, there is a very high likelihood that Medicaid benefits, these long-term adult Medicaid, long-term care Medicaid benefits would be paid. But then if the house is not structured correctly, then Medicaid has the legal right to place a lien on the property and to sell the property for reimbursement. Because there's just, it's like beyond the scope of what I can even go through on the radio today. But for example, one of the things that happens is that, you know, the home place is a non-countable asset for Medicaid purposes. They won't count it if there's an intent to return home. So a very simple document can be signed, even a document that the Department of Social Services would provide, indicating an intent to return home, but that does not protect the property from the lien. One of the very important steps that we put in place, and other attorneys, law firms that do long-term health care planning, is to do that second step to structure the real estate, and especially I'm talking about the home right now, in a non-probate posture with the correct type of document. So when that circumstance takes place, the person has received Medicaid, maybe for months, maybe for a year, maybe for years. Could be, and my goodness, Cecil, we've seen liens of $200,000-$400,000 before.
Wow.
I mean, really high numbers. We've seen the house being forced into sale. It's hard to deal with that on the back end unless the planning is done on the front end.
It really is one of probably the most difficult files that we see. I would say the way to kind of explain it, Lockwood, is we manage those files. We attempt to get some benefit for the family with negotiation at the Attorney General's office, who handles the recovery, if you will, of the Medicaid payments that are made when their land is in the estate. And we can, under some circumstances, structure a closing. There can be expenses on the property, which can be an offset for the family. But the result in those kinds of files is not at all what Wes and I and the other lawyers at our law firm, we're a high result, a positive result law firm. I mean, we
Understood.
Want the very highest result for our clients, and that's always our objective. And these are files where we're sometimes just not able to quite get the result that we would like to get. Now, the alternative is just so easy, because if that property had been transferred to a trust, reserving a life estate to maintain the step-up in basis for the Medicaid applicant, and the asset, the home, had been transferred, or the land, farm, whatever it is, to a trust, then in the state of North Carolina, we are not an expanded jurisdiction. We are an estate-only recovery jurisdiction. And so the offices in Raleigh at that point do not seek recovery against a trust. they do seek recovery against the estate, and that's why we're very busy at our law firm transferring these real property assets out of the estate or out of the decedent's name during their lifetime into a format that would be a trust arrangement. We're also able to do this trust arrangement, Lockwood, during the lifetime of our elder client without generating the five-year look-back rule, by the way. And that is a common question that we get. We hear, you know, Mr. Collins, Mr. Harvell, we know we can do these transfers, but we've waited too long. We don't think we can transfer the farm or the property or the home place at this point. Mom or dad or grandmama, granddaddy, you know, are all but entering into the assisted living and or the long-term care nursing home environment, and we think we waited too long. With regard to the real estate, we are able to transfer it in a manner whereby it does not trigger the sanction period. In other words, we can make the transfer without the five-year look-back rule applying. That is big news. That's highlighted to our listeners right now. So even though you may think that you've waited too long, go ahead and seek the proper kind of legal advice, because you may very likely can transfer the asset in a manner whereby it does not trigger that five-year look-back rule.
You know, one of the things that really catches my attention here, and we're talking with Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins of Harvell and Collins, and by the way, the topic really is avoiding the major mistakes that many people face when they're planning their estate management. And that's the reason for our conversations with Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins at Harvell and Collins. Cecil, Wes, the thing that surprises me is that the fact that an estate, for example, an individual who is receiving Medicaid assistance and through the benefits of the government, their Medicaid program, or Medicare program, the fact that the estate could be saddled with expenses if it's not structured properly, that is a stunning development or issue for me. I didn't realize that. And again, it's not only a matter of taking care of the individual who is receiving the care, but also their family, their beneficiaries. That's, I think, pretty important.
There's no question about that. And I was just having a conversation late yesterday afternoon with a client who could only talk after, you know, 6 o'clock and work, and his parents are in these situations at this point. And the cost of care now, Lockwood, has just become astronomical. Everything, as we know in our world, all our listeners are listening, and they all know. I mean, you know, gosh, a gallon of milk is more than we ever thought it would be. Everything is so expensive. You know, I say to clients, unfortunately, lawyers are so expensive, Lockwood. Wes and I don't like the fact that we are as expensive as we are, lawyers and other professionals, but it's just so real, the cost of doing business, the insurances and the computer technology and the personnel and that we need and all that we need in order to do an effective and very results-driven practice for clients is expensive, and so therefore the lawyers are expensive. Mm-hmm. But the bottom line is that long-term care in the home, assisted living and assisted living facilities, it is just really beyond what most people are able to afford. And so more and more people are looking for a balance with this. There might be some period of time that they've paid for assistance in the home, or that they've paid for assisted living, or that they've even paid for nursing care. But there comes a point where they just simply are not able to continue to withstand the financial cost of those kinds of things, and it is very important that our listeners seek legal advice, because in a lot of those zones, there are things that we're able to do to help.
you know, the other aspect of this, and a lot of this is related to baby boomers, and of course now we have long-term care insurance, things of that nature, but for many of the baby boomers, that insurance was not available when they were in their productive years. So a lot of these children now, grandchildren, are faced with the potential of an onerous, if you will, expense. Even if they the parents do take efforts to take care of themselves for long-term care, this whole aspect of the clawback is my comment is that's something that we all need to be aware of.
Right, long-term care insurance is definitely something that we like to see. We look at that when we're dealing with our clients, mm-hmm. But we do recognize that in many cases, long-term care insurance might have a 2-year term or a 3-year term. Sometimes it's unlimited, but that's rare, and that's usually very expensive as far as the premiums go. Many times with regard to long-term care insurance, we're supplementing that with additional planning to just make sure that, in the event we have a stay in a care facility that exceeds the term or the limits of the policy, that we have, that additional layer, to protect other assets such as the home. But to transition a little bit, our primary topic today is to, talking about mistakes. And I think that our, kind of on the list of mistakes issue that brought us to this conversation regarding long-term health care and these type issues was failure to complete planning as it relates to Medicaid, and then having a rude awakening because you thought everything was okay and mm-hmm. it isn't, and then it's hard to deal with it later on. Like I said a moment ago, dealing with this type of issue is not very difficult on the front end. It's near impossible on the back end after someone's passed away and assets are structured how they are and in a way that's not not proper. So, again, I agree with Cecil. We're very results-oriented, expense. Everything's expensive, like Cecil indicated. We know that. Attorney's fees, they could be expensive. But I can tell you that it's very rare that we have a case that the cost of the work that we do doesn't pay back the client in, maybe even 10 times more. I mean, much, yeah. much more. Very rare. So it may be expensive, but good legal work is valuable. So that sounds kind of self-serving, but, that's not really my purpose here. My purpose is just to explain that that's kind of the way that goes. And, another issue kind of transitioning a little bit, other mistakes. I think we may have touched on this, previously, maybe last week, but, I was just in court yesterday on – multiple motions here in Civil Superior Court before Judge Disbro. He's a Brunswick County judge. First time I've been before him, very good judge. I'll indicate that. But anyway, we had a hearing on one issue with regard to a will that had been lost. And this was really a caveat case because a will from 1980 had been probated. Mm-hmm. But the mother of the three daughters had another will that she did in 2007. And my client is the primary beneficiary of that 2007 will. So we had filed a caveat. But one of the biggest issues that we're having to deal with in that case is that we don't have the original will. So let's mark that down as a big no-no. Let's not lose our original will. Let's keep that original will with our family, with our important papers. Let's make sure it's in the safe deposit box. Let's make sure it's our attorney is holding it, as we do at Harvell and Collins. We hold all of our original important estate planning documents in our vault system, which we're actually upgrading right now because of space needs. Mm-hmm. Because we do that as a free service for our clients because we know how important it is that we don't, or the clients don't lose those original right. documents. So in that particular case that I had yesterday, and this is this is not rare. This is something I deal with quite frequently. You know, I have to go through a process of petitioning the court for the probate of a lost will. And there's a whole host of additional elements that I have to prove in order for the court to probate that. Because the presumption is, if you don't have the original will, we start out with a presumption that it was destroyed. Okay, that it was intentionally destroyed, mm-hmm. obliterated, done away with. So if we have the original, then I don't have to deal with that presumption. So it makes it much more complicated, much more difficult when I'm dealing with the probate of a document that is a copy as opposed to the original, mm-hmm. original will. So do what we need to do in order to hold on to those, because when our loved one passes away and we're needing to, you know, probate that estate, marching over to the courthouse with a properly drafted, attested written will with a self-proving affidavit, and it's the original, is a whole lot easier than, you know, a lawsuit asking the court to probate a copy.
And I'm curious, is there, so there's the, there is only one original. You cannot have, if you will, copies made that are somehow attested to by witnesses.
Well, you could have the same document executed in duplicate two times or three times, triplicate, you know, and we would have three originals, but that just normally doesn't happen.
Okay.
That gets a little messy. It's normally one document, but even photocopies, the best photocopy in the world is still not the original.
All right.
So, maybe we're still in the Stone Ages. I think we touched on this last week in the context of beneficiary designations mm-hmm. being changed on documents and how easy it is to do that
yep.
compared to the ceremony of signing a will. That's kind of where we touched on that. But as far as the will goes, yes, the original is the original. And there normally is only one. So that's
and cool. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's it.
And that's right. And to just expand on that a bit, Lockwood, in these last, few minutes before we go to a different topic, we do have a few more topics okay. here of these big mistakes. But to expand on this original, it is, as Wes says, the location of the original, mm-hmm. and it's very safe in our vault system. But the other concepts, there are lots of other reasons why years and years and years ago we decided to establish this vault system, is that, the original at a home or in a lockbox or in a safe, in a filing cabinet at home,
right.
the client can pull the original out and start writing on it, making little changes
right.
That they think are important, and they don't realize that they are, now potentially even revoking, certainly obliterating an original document. The other thing is that someone blessed, in this world, and, sin does exist in our world, I guess, unfortunately, Lockwood, someone in the family finds the original and doesn't like what it says,
right.
okay?
Mm-hmm.
And so now it mysteriously disappears. We've had a number of those files in our office where the client is very deliberate about the fact that the original document mom or dad had, but, so-and-so took it, and we don't have it, and they won't give it to us. They say it's lost. Yeah, well, more than likely, there was something in it that they did not like to see, so now it is just mysteriously missing.
Mm-hmm.
So someone can lose the document. Someone can write on the document. Someone can find the document and not like what it says. Not to mention, all of these kinds of things can happen to an original. So we like to kind of hold on to that. The executor has the authority to obtain the original. We have that happen on a daily basis at the law firm where an executor will call or the client. But But we also have calls, Lockwood, from someone in the family who just wants to get, you know, a copy or an original or even the original. And, of course, they're not entitled to that. Only the client and only the executor are entitled to receive those originals. And so we have to be very – our staff at the office has to be very cautious about that when phone calls come in from folks that are not authorized to receive the documents. So there's a lot of ifs, ands, or buts out there about an original document. Mm-hmm. As Wes brought up, there's more to the story.
All right, and other mistakes that we've seen from time to time.
One of the biggest that I just see every single day. Every single day is a not well drafted durable power of attorney. Okay, folks come into our office. They bring in some power of attorney that they received off the internet, or the short form power of attorney that they obtained from a lawyer's office, even where the lawyer is, you know, really not an estate lawyer. And so there are all these initials off to the side of what the agent under the power of attorney can and cannot do. So here we go. If you, listeners, if you look at your power of attorney or look at your loved one's power of attorney, and you look on the pages and you just see a lot of initials off to the side of real estate transaction, business transaction, estate transaction, quite frankly, that power of attorney needs to be updated. It is not detailed in a sufficient manner to allow the agent to do those kinds of things. The power of attorney in an elder law context needs to grant very specifically the power to sign this intent to return home. Uh-huh. Very specifically, this power or grant of authority for the agent to create, modify, or amend an irrevocable trust. These very important grants of authority need to be specifically set forth in the power of attorney. Stock companies and investment firms, the Merrill Lynch's of the world, the Fidelities of the world, many of them have their own power of attorney that they prefer be used, and we're okay with that, okay? That's fine. But if you're going to use a short-form power of attorney, one of these with all of these initials, the stock companies, investment firms are not going to be comfortable with it because it does not have the very specific language that they want to see with regard to handling an investment account. It just isn't detailed enough. We need to keep in mind that when the world out there relies on an agent under a power of attorney, they are concerned about their liability. And the more detail that is in the power of attorney to the investment firm, to the bank, to the Department of Social Services, the more detail there is in the power of attorney, the more comfortable they're going to become. These short-form powers of attorney with lots of initials, I put that in the category of a big mistake, Lockwood.
Wow. Okay. This goes back to something you mentioned, Wes, and that is the ceremony of it all, that the fact that these documents have they're significant, and to your point there, Cecil, you know, just a casual form doesn't work this day and age, and I can appreciate that from the perspective of those financial institutions. There's a significant liability if they are not paying attention to the details.
Yeah, Lockwood has never made much sense to me that, you know, we work so hard and we work 40 hours a week or 50 hours a week or whatever it is to make ends meet and build a maybe some money for retirement and pay off our mortgage and build a little bit to pass down to our loved ones and who we want to leave it to. And then these mistakes that we talk about are made, or there's inattention to these details that you just mentioned and brought up. And all of that life's work, or a significant amount of it, is for naught because something happens because we failed to plan. As we say sometimes, failing to plan is planning to fail.
Right.
So, you know, spending all of that time and effort and, you know, work in our, you know, through our lives and then setting ourselves up by not having long-term care planning in place and potentially having a huge expense for the end of our life because of a healthcare need that could have been easily avoided. Just doesn't make sense to me. You know, not paying attention to, you know, holding on to where that original will is so that we make sure that our assets go exactly where they want them to go. We don't have additional things that our loved ones have to do that they might win, they might lose on with regard to that will because we don't have the original. Not taking care of the beneficiary designations to make sure that they go, assets go where we want them to go. Making sure the power of attorney is perfect. And these are all things that just a good attorney is going to go over with you and make sure, you know, are covered. And so it's just goes to the ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure theme.
Well, in some instances, you pointed out, Wes, no cure available, unfortunately.
Yes. Yeah.
Wow.
While the individual is still living and has capacity to be able to make decisions for him or herself, we can, in many cases, work out and put in place a plan that is very, very helpful to the family. But in after the death or after incapacity, in some cases, not all, but in some cases, you know, it's much more difficult to do to really get the benefit or get the result that the family could have otherwise gotten. So staying ahead of it, making sure everything is in proper order is very important from my perspective after doing this for, you know, 25 years, and Cecil's done it longer than that. So,
wow. We're talking with Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins of Harvell and Collins, and we're talking about, sadly, the big mistakes that folks make. And the ultimate conclusion on that, Cecil and Wes, is we failed to sit down and just, and quite frankly, make a simple phone call. 252 area code 726-9050. 726-9050. Make the phone call to Harvell and Collins, and don't hesitate to give them a look at their website, harvellandcollins.com. And with that, Cecil, Wes, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you, Lockwood.